This is the Environment Show. It's about our stewardship of the Earth and the beauty and mystery of life in all its forms. I'm Peter Burley. Coming up, New York City is producing garbage at a great rate. The Supreme Court says trash can be shipped in interstate commerce, but it's a product some folks in Virginia think they have enough of. Will year 2000 computer crashes pollute the country with sewage and nuclear waste? The EPA doesn't think so. We hike to a distant hillside in Burma, where there's more to talk about than pagodas and the scenery. And on the Earth calendar, great horned owls are hooting and getting ready to hatch. These stories and more coming up on the Environment Show. You're listening to The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. Disposing of garbage is a responsibility every community must address. But for New York City, it's a major effort. 7.3 million people live there and produce about 13,000 tons of trash a day. For the past 30 years, most of the city's trash was sent to the Fresh Kills landfill on Staten Island. But now, the fill is reaching its holding capacity, which is putting environmental pressures on other states. The Environment Show's Stephen Westcott explains.
Fresh Kills landfill will be officially closed on December 31st, 2001. In a gradual effort to reduce New York's reliance on the fill, the Department of Sanitation began diverting garbage elsewhere in 1997. Michael Carpinello is acting commissioner for the department.
And some of that waste goes to the state of Virginia, some goes to Connecticut. A little bit goes to an incinerator in New Jersey. And there are outlets, you know, all over the United States. And the companies that we enter into a contract with to transport and dispose of the waste have contracts with many localities throughout the United States as to where this waste can be delivered.
The state of Virginia is receiving about 82% of the waste being shipped out of New York City. About 3,500 tons of trash is arriving by truck and rail daily. A number of Virginia state legislators, as well as Governor Gilmore, are taking steps to slow the flood of trash pouring into the Commonwealth. John Paul Woodley, Jr. is Secretary for Natural Resources.
Under current law in Virginia, the total capacity for a landfill is set by the permit, but there is no current provision in Virginia law for a cap on the daily or yearly capacity for a landfill, and that is something that our General Assembly is in session right now and is looking very closely at.
Another proposal would toughen overall regulations on landfills and trash hauling, and a third would ban the use of garbage barges on Virginia's waterways. Critics of this proposal say outlawing barges only puts more trucks on the roadways, which contributes to air pollution. In the past, Supreme Court rulings have barred states from blocking interstate trade, and some in the waste industry will likely argue that these proposals do just that. Despite criticisms from some residents, legislators, and environmentalists, New York City's Michael Carpinello says there are some in Virginia and other states who favor importing trash.
The U.S. senators and the governors of those states have voiced opposition, but when you talk to the local elected officials, they tell us, send us your trash. So even within the state itself, there are differences of opinion as to who wants it and who doesn't want it. And that's something I think that each state has to grapple with.
Carpinello adds that by selling landfill space, local elected officials are helping to generate money for their communities, money that pays for schools and parks. However, the safety of Virginia's landfills is a subject of much discussion in the state. Reports say a number of old landfills are polluting groundwater supplies and that the owners of these fills cannot be found and held accountable. Again, John Paul Woodley, Natural Resources Secretary for Virginia.
It's a very substantial problem based on the fact that, of course, for many years, prior to the implementation of these new requirements for leachate collection systems, linings, and the other engineering requirements that we have in the modern landfills, the landfills that were in service didn't have those, and are therefore not as environmentally safe as more modern facilities. And some of those are, in fact, are posing a danger to the state.
Woodley says a proposal is being considered that would create a state fund to help communities deal with environmental problems caused by old landfills.
Right now, we're in the we're actually in a monitoring and evaluation phase, but I think that we will very soon, particularly if this fund is that we're proposing is approved by the General Assembly, be coming forward to in partnership with localities to actually take some remedial action.
Overall, Woodley says the trash coming in from New York City is mainly being deposited in 7 lined landfills with leachate systems. Waste Management, the Houston-based company contracted by New York City to transport waste to Virginia, is the largest trash hauler in the country. Recently, it was caught illegally dumping medical waste into a landfill in Virginia. Among the items allegedly found were bloodied sheets and syringes. Last year, the company also reportedly admitted to violating dumping limits in a county landfill. Efforts to contact Waste Management for an interview for this report were unsuccessful. Meantime, John Paul Woodley believes most of the companies currently operating landfills in Virginia are responsible. He says it is his department's job to make sure the state can handle large volumes of waste from New York City and protect the environment for future generations at the same time. It's a big job now that Virginia imports the 2nd most trash of any state in the nation, behind Pennsylvania. Even if Woodley can deal with New York City waste in an environmentally acceptable manner, whether he can do it in a way that is politically acceptable remains to be seen. For the Environment Show, I'm Stephen Westcott.
There is a lot of buzz these days about how the world is going to come to an end on January 1, 2000, when all the computers that manage our life support systems malfunction. The problem, known as Y2K, derives from the computer's programming, which tells it that a year numbered by 2 zeros is 1900. Since this is before 1999, the computer shuts down or does funny things as it lacks the capacity to contemplate time running backwards. Norman Dean, who is executive director of a nonprofit organization called Center for Y2K and Society, describes some of the environmental problems that Y2K presents.
First, there's the big problem of nuclear power plants and plants which manufacture and utilize highly toxic materials. And the question there is whether computer malfunctions in those facilities could result in releases of highly dangerous materials into the environment. About 85 million Americans live within 5 miles of a plant that handles highly hazardous chemicals or nuclear materials, and therefore it's a significant concern.
There are 108 nuclear plants in the United States and 433 worldwide. The concern is that a prolonged shutdown of the pumps which run systems that cool the cores could result in overheating, possibly causing meltdown and toxic releases. Analysts who have looked at American plants seem to agree that the risk of release is very small, since the plants are taking corrective action. They also agree that predicting what may happen abroad, in Russia, and other places with nuclear plants is nearly impossible. At this time, Norman Dean's greater concern is with the 66,000 plants in the United States that produce or handle hazardous chemicals.
External experts, other experts have offered the opinion that we are not doing enough to assure the safety of those chemical facilities. The Federal Chemical Safety and Hazard Investigation Board held a meeting in December in which representatives of the chemical industry, nonprofit organizations, and government were brought together. And there was considerable concern among participants in that meeting that more needed to be done to protect these facilities. The larger plants, those operated by Fortune 500 companies, have received a great deal of attention. The problem becomes when you get to the small and mid-sized businesses. In the smaller and mid-sized businesses, fully half of those firms have done nothing to respond to Y2K, and about a third of them that have been surveyed say that they don't have the resources to do anything and don't intend to do anything.
Another major area of environmental concern arising out of Y2K has to do with sewage treatment and drinking water. The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency is working on this issue. Alvin Bisakowicz, Deputy Assistant Administrator for Administration and Resources, thinks the situation is in hand. He says EPA is working with state water associations, which have been surveying the nation's 55,000 water systems.
Of the large systems, and the very large systems, those supplying water to more than 10,000 people in the case of large systems, and greater than 100,000 people for the very large systems, they service more than 80% of the U.S. population. For these systems, the initial survey, which was completed in September by a group of associations, indicated that in the neighborhood of close to 90% of those systems would be or expect to be compliant with year 2000 issues. We have a little bit more concern, I think, when we deal with smaller and medium-sized water systems.
To encourage plants to test whether Y2K modifications are effective, EPA says it will withhold enforcement proceeding against those that exceed pollution discharge permits if the violation occurred while testing for Y2K readiness. It will enforce for pollution discharges which occur after January 1. While wastewater and drinking water plants are generally run by local governments, most pollution monitoring equipment is found in private sector plants. With respect to them, Norman Dean says Y2K preparedness is mixed.
The second significant issue is the question of the priorities that corporations are attaching to Y2K problems in the environment. Almost every company is having to set priorities when it's tackling the Y2K problem, and most companies are only addressing what they call mission-critical aspects of their operations, things that are absolutely critical to keep them up and running. Unfortunately, from all that we can tell, pollution control and pollution control monitoring is not considered mission-critical by many firms.
In spite of gloom and doom predictions about Y2K, Alvin Pisakowicz from the EPA says his agency is confident and Americans should not fear major environmental consequences.
I think that we are reasonably optimistic that the environmental problems will be minimum. We have certainly recognized overall, both for the environmental area and in general, that not every computer will be fixed by the year 2000. But we don't expect any major national disruptions in any critical services. And I think with that, the American people can feel a little bit more comfortable.
Bisakowicz still advises that people take simple precautions as the new year approaches, like securing some extra flashlight batteries and non-perishable food. You can also get further information by calling 1-888-USA-4Y2K or go to the website www.y2k.gov. In case you're feeling more comfortable about Y2K threats, there is another computer problem you can worry about if you're inclined to do so. It turns out that years back, some programmers used the numbers 9999 to instruct a system to stop. Translated into the calendar, that is September 9 of this year. Also, on August 21 of this year, the satellite global positioning system may have a rollover problem. So don't plan to get lost on your August vacation. Personally, I'm looking forward to all these computer failure drop-dead dates. Computer failure is a far more plausible and credible excuse for not doing those things you were supposed to than the dog ate my homework. Nature Sounds for the Environment Show are provided by Lang Elliott, Nature Sound Studio, www.naturesound.com. The show is a national production. It's made possible by the W. Alton Jones Foundation, the William Bingham Foundation, the Turner Foundation, the J.M. Kaplan Fund, and Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the collector car hobby. www.hemmings.com. We'd like to hear from you. Give us a call. The number is 1-888-49-GREEN. That's 1-888-49-GREEN. Email is green@wamc.org. That's green@wamc.org. We all have places that are special to us. For some, it's a city street. For others, it's deep in the wilderness. I encountered a special place while hiking in the hills of Myanmar in January 1999. I've written an essay about it, which I've called A Place to Talk. The mandolin player is blind. He plays at the entrance to an open-air market in a village in the hills of Myanmar, the country formerly known as Burma. His bare toes curl around a wooden shaft that is attached to some bells on a wooden rack next to him. And with a flick of his ankle, the bells ring out the beat. The din in the background comes from the market, which is filled with lines of women squatting on the dirt in front of baskets of ginger, cauliflower, potatoes, carrots, as well as fresh and dried fish. Some vendors have little charcoal fires, cooking pots of noodles, rice, and vegetables which are sold by the plateful. The charcoal smoke permeates everything. It's busy. In a village without refrigeration, this is the place each morning where food is bought and sold for the day's consumption. So the market is full, with people chattering as they walk up and down between the vendors. I leave the market with a young man who offers to take me to a nearby village. We head up a dusty path. It's deeply rutted from the wooden wheels of ox carts that must have sunk close to 2 feet in the mud during rainy season. But now, light yellow dust puffs up around the ankle at every step. The January sky is a cloudless, clear blue, like New England in September. Our track meanders up hillsides quilted with hand-tilled fields and topped with pagodas. In flatter places, peanuts, corn, and plants with big green leaves that are rolled into cheroots reflect the care of peasant farmers whose only tools are grub hoes and wooden rakes. After the first 6 miles, we come to a village. Thatch houses are surrounded by wooden fences. The ground is swept absolutely clean with no trace of the constant impacts of oxen and the children who are everywhere. Thunk, 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 thunk. The pounding noise comes from behind a house where two young women are grinding grain. They each have a log which they raise above their head and slam alternatively into a stone dish. I try it but can't seem to hit the dish exactly in the middle or match the perfect cadence set by the lady opposite me. She's half my size, and heists the 4-foot pounding log above her head with fluidity and grace. My clumsiness inspires giggles from her and the collection of villagers who have gathered to watch. 6 miles later, we pass through another village. We wind through several clumps of bamboo and start traversing a long, treeless, sloping hillside. This is the drier side of the ridge. The hills are farther apart, and a broad valley below us is rosy. The soil in the open fields is a brick red, and the stubble from last year's upland rice crop is a rosy brown. The next village is visible 2 ridges and several miles ahead of us. A dozen women working shoulder to shoulder form a line in a field below. They too are swinging heavy tools above their heads as they hoe the ground, but they are so far away the sound does not reach us. We can see the track for a couple of miles ahead of us and behind us. No one is visible. My friend turns and says, "This is a place we can talk." And then the words come quickly. "I hate my government. Nobody here can talk about the government, even to their friends. If the army hears that you've been talking, they come at night and take you away. They always come at night. Sometimes people are brought back to their villages after 6 months, but they're disoriented and die 10 days later. The ones that don't die cannot walk because their spines were injured when they were tortured. I can only say this here because nobody can see me talking to you." The sun is lower in the sky. It highlights the spire of a pagoda on the horizon. In the distance, a couple of people appear. One is carrying a basket on her head, and my friend turns away. We can't talk anymore, not even here. I'm Peter Burley. The essay is entitled "A Place to Talk," based on sounds and experiences I encountered in Myanmar, formerly known as Burma, in January 1999. And now it's time for the Earth Calendar. That's the call of female and male great horned owls. And right now, they're nesting in many parts of the United States and Canada. Courtship begins in October, with mating usually occurring around the end of January. The females lay 2 eggs about a week later, according to Dr. Noble Proctor, ornithologist at Southern Connecticut State University.
If there is a lot of food around, they will go up to 5, but you would need a tremendous food supply. So the norm in this area is 2, and for the outside numbers of 3.
When the chicks begin hatching in early or mid-March, Dr. Proctor says they're white and fuzzy. After a week, they begin growing their first pin feathers and turning tan in color. They soon gain ear tufts, which are nothing more than feathers, that give the great horned owl its name.
At about 5 weeks, they're so big, they overflow the nest. The owls in general will adapt an old crow's nest rather than building one completely on their own. And because of the small size of it, by 5 weeks, these huge baby owls are beginning to limb out. We call it limbing out. They go out onto the outer branches and leave the nest because they've practically destroyed it. And then the parents will tend to them, both parents will tend to them, for another 5 weeks or so. And at 10 weeks, they then will start to move around with the parent.
Professor Proctor says the parents bring rabbits, squirrels, and even skunks back to the nest to feed their young. But with time, the offspring learn how to hunt on their own and will leave their parents in the fall.
And you can always tell when the separation comes, when the adults are getting ready to nest again, and they have, in effect, weaned away the young. On October nights over open fields, you'll hear young, in effect, begging for the parents that are no longer in attendance. And you'll hear, wah, 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 as they're flying over the fields, begging for food. Middle of the night, parents now have weaned them away. It's all up to them to start hunting, and the parents go off to breed.
Great horned owls are the largest owls in North America. They have a wingspan of about 4 feet and are about 2.5 feet tall. Their talons or claws are powerful and quite large, about the size of a human hand. Regardless of how big they are, as Professor Proctor mentioned, the juveniles are still hard to wean. Maybe this is the intangible bond humans have long had with owls. But owls don't get a syndrome from the empty nest. They just fill it again in the next breeding season. You're listening to The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. You're listening to The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. Still ahead, can you get paid to protect the environment? The Complete Guide to Environmental Careers in the 21st Century has just been published. The author tells us where the jobs are. We talk green about how to invest your money in environmentally sound companies and make a profit. It's green investing, and there are a lot of mutual funds that do it. Some experts tell us how. It's not for everybody. But the Rucka Society is teaching the art of passive resistance to folk who want to protest against environmental insults. Linda Anderson introduces us to the founders of the group. Stay with us. A lot has changed over the last 5 years in the spectrum of environmental careers. That's the message from the environmental careers organization known as ECO, a national nonprofit group based in Boston. ECO recently released its latest edition of the Complete Guide to Environmental Careers in the 21st Century. Among other things, the book outlines where environmental job seekers should and should not be looking. Stephen Westcott reports.
Not surprisingly, the growing problem of urban sprawl and its effects are creating greater employment opportunities for civil engineers, planners, and other positions relating to growth management. Kevin Doyle is ECO's National Director of Program Development.
The other area that is probably one of the biggest is the whole area of pollution prevention and toxics use reduction. As we move from an environmental economy that it's focused on dealing with waste after it's created, how to transport it, store it, dispose of it, reduce it. That kind of world creates one kind of jobs. If we're talking about a world in which we're trying to prevent pollution, then you have a whole different kind of job focused on people like process engineers, people who redesign processes so that you don't create pollution in the first place.
Doyle says much of today's environmental work is divided into two areas that fall under the category of conservation.
We're talking about fisheries, wildlife biologists, people working on, for instance, under the Endangered Species Act, foresters, and so forth. And then environmental protection people, water quality, air quality, hazardous waste, solid waste, recycling, and so forth. So in the area of what most people think of as conservation work, the most popular field right now is called conservation biology, which also might be called like an ecosystems approach to biology as opposed to a single species approach.
Doyle says specialized positions such as biologists who work only with one type of salmon, for example, or botanists who focus on a particular plant are declining in number.
Another area that is declining is the need for a lot of stationary laboratories, analytical laboratories, hiring bench chemists who sit in an actual building, receiving soil samples, water samples, air samples, and so forth, dealing with that, that is also declining, and it's declining because of technology. We can now take a lot of those samples right on site and analyze them on site and produce the reports on site.
With the Republicans controlling Congress in recent years, Kevin Doyle says there have been reductions in regulations as well as staffing. He says the Department of the Interior has reduced its workforce by 10%. More private firms are handling work that used to be conducted by this department. Doyle says Environmental Careers Organization has some suggestions for those interested in being employed in various environmental fields. He says even if you have decided on a particular career, you can make yourself more marketable if you have dual specialties.
And that would be, for instance, people who combine science and business, or maybe law and management, people who combine engineering with an MBA. Those kind of mix-and-match approaches, which are represented, for instance, by the Nicholas School of Environment at Duke University, which is a great master's program, by the Yale School of Environment and Forestry, by the University of Michigan School of Natural Resources. These are great approaches to combining two things that we used to think of as being represented in different human beings.
In addition, Doyle says as the global economy expands, there will be a greater need for workers who are multi or bilingual. He also expects more women and minorities to begin entering environmental job markets. Doyle says other jobs expected to be in high demand are in the categories of computer and technology, chemistry, and landscape engineering. You can find more information on the Environmental Careers Organization on your personal computer. The website address is www.eco.org. For the Environment Show, I'm Stephen Westcott.
We are Talking Green, and I'm Peter Burley. Today we're going to be talking about investment and the environment. Can you put your nest egg in a SOX and so-called green companies and get a good return? Are the more environmentally responsible companies as profitable as those that are not? If you want to be a green investor, how do you do it? We're going to be talking to folk who have spent a lot of time thinking about this. My guests are Elisa Gravitz, and she is vice president of the Social Investment Forum. That's a nonprofit association which is dedicated to promoting the practice of socially responsible investing, and she joins us from Washington.
Hello.
Straight from Wall Street is Linda Descano, and she is senior vice president for environmental affairs with Solomon Smith Barney, which is a major Wall Street brokerage firm. She's also chair of the steering committee of the United Nations Financial Institutions Initiative on the Environment. Welcome to you both.
Hi, Peter.
Elisa, you've been with us before, but for folk that may not have heard it last time, just to get us started, what do you mean when we talk about green investment?
Well, green investing is a subset of what people call socially responsible investing, which is a simple concept, which is when you put your money to work in investments, you're literally creating the products and services of the future. So why not do two things at once, get the kinds of financial returns that you want, and also invest in the kind of world you want to live in?
Now, let me ask you, Linda, from Solomon Smith Barney, the tough question. When we talk about green investing, when I talk to my friends on Wall Street, they usually give me this sort of benign smile that you give to an innocent and somewhat backward child. They think it's a nice idea, but real tough men and women who are making money don't make money this way.
Well, I think you're absolutely right. In general, most of Wall Street doesn't understand how environmental strategies contribute to a company's performance, profitability, and growth. However, increasingly, there is a growing evidence in the business literature that documents that companies who use certain types of environmental behavior can actually improve their performance through improved operating efficiency, new and improved products, or new markets. However, by and large, companies are really not engaging the average investor and financial analyst in a dialogue about what the environment means to their bottom line.
Now, Elisa, we have heard about green funds. How do they work, and do they produce returns for the investor that would match some other kind of a mutual fund?
Absolutely. And I think that Linda just stated that it absolutely right on, but she's being very polite. I think another way to say it is Wall Street's about 10 years behind the times. Both market performance and the academic literature that Linda's citing both show that you can invest green and do well. Let me give you some examples. Let's say it's December 31st, 1998. How do you feel about 42.8% return over last year? Well, one of the socially responsible index funds gave that to you. How would you feel about 42.7% returns over that year? Again, a different fund gave you that. So the bottom line is that if you're an investor and you care about it, the environment, you have to make good investing choices. You have to choose your mutual funds wisely. You have to know what your financial goals are and design a portfolio to meet that. But you can do well by investing green.
Well, before we get away from that, I happen to have in front of me the page in the March issue of Consumer Reports, which is devoted to mutual funds. And I note that the returns that they show on a list of socially conscious funds are at least as good as the list of returns on other kinds of funds that they categorize. So if one wants to do this, how do you figure out, since I'm sure there are bad ones as well as good ones, how do you find out which is a green mutual fund that you might want to buy?
Well, probably the quickest way is to turn to the World Wide Web and look at www.socialinvest.org. That's www.socialinvest.org. On that site, the Social Investment Forum lists the socially responsible mutual funds, and you can look at all different kinds of funds, what their performance is, and what their style is. That is, so that you can diversify your portfolio. You can find all equity funds, you can find international funds, you can find index funds, you can find large cap funds, you can find small cap funds. So basically, the good news for investors is not only can you get the performance that you want, but you can get the diversity that you want in your investment portfolio, all staying in that socially responsible arena.
Linda Descano, how does the Wall Street community, you're with one of the great big mm-hmm. firms, how do they look at this? Do they still see this as kind of a sideline that a few fuzzy green people invest in, or do they see this as a really potential growing market?
Well, I think it's mixed. Part of Wall Street still views green investment as a niche market that, you know, appeals to environmental activists and you know, people who look for warm and fuzzy feeling.
Folks like us who want to save
right.
the world.
However, increasingly, it's being recognized as just a smart investment strategy. As more evidence is coming out about how companies are actually improving their bottom line, you know, doing well by doing good. And as the demographics change in terms of investing, I mean, studies in Canada and the United Kingdom and even in the United States show that more money is being put into socially screened assets. And in fact, research that Solomon Smith Barney conducted showed that more women are concerned about social responsibility and environmental responsibility in their investment decision making. So in order to appeal to the needs of these new investors, Wall Street has to stand up and take notice and provide the kinds of products that are going to meet their customers' concerns. And in fact, over the past 18 months, particularly in Europe, there has been a new type of environmental investment fund launch called an environmental value fund, which seeks to integrate sort of the traditional fundamental investment discipline with an environmental analysis that focuses on the strategic and the positive types of practices companies are participating in. And their performance has been very good, as Alicia said. And I think it's the the outperformance of these funds that is starting to get the attention of Wall Street. But again, we are behind the times, but I think we're making terrific progress because of the quality of the academic studies that have been published that provide hardcore documentation that links improved environmental performance with improved financial performance.
I've talked to CEOs of some very big companies who say, listen, for us, if we can cut down, say, our toxic waste emissions, then the raw materials that go into those are being used to make product instead. And also, our costs go way down because we're not paying an arm and a leg to process these things in environmentally sound places. So they talk bottom line and seem to be making it work. In the kind of analysis that firms like yours do when you make recommendations on the stock market, do you look at that kind of stuff?
Well, I think it depends on the type of industry sector we're talking about and, of course, the issues that are most relevant to that sector at a particular time. Certainly, when there are changes in environmental laws or there is some type of an incident such as an explosion or an oil spill, that focuses attention. I don't think the average analyst focuses on levels of emissions or levels of waste. However, what they're trying to understand are how large-scale issues like climate change or biotechnology changing the structure of a particular sector, and what does that mean to a company's business strategy and planning, and what does that mean to their future earnings and revenue opportunities. So, but unfortunately, most companies don't really talk about the environment in strategic concepts. They talk about it in terms of pounds of toxics or emissions, which the average investor and financial analyst isn't equipped to translate into earnings per share impact.
Unless, of course, they're sitting on a Superfund site. That's right.
Well, unfortunately, most of the focus is on issues such as Superfund because that's something that people can put a price tag on.
Right. Lisa, let me get back to the private investor for a moment, the folk who probably may be listening to this show. Can they be assured if they pick a green mutual fund, again for their IRA or for their 401k or for their modest savings, that they stand as good a chance of getting as high a rate of return as they might get on some other kind of a mutual fund if they pick the right one?
Well, as you know, Peter, in the investment world, we always say past performance is no guarantee of the future. So I think the bottom line for each of us as private investors to understand is that both the market performance so far and the academic studies are showing that the proposition is that you can do as well as conventional investing when you make socially responsible or green investing choices. We at the Social Investment Forum feel that that trend is not only going to continue, but it's going to improve precisely because of some of the studies that Linda is talking about. Let me give you just one example. A couple professors at the University of Oregon just published a peer-reviewed study, very rigorous review, in the Academy of Management Journal. They basically concluded that their research found that companies with superior environmental performance had higher returns on investment compared to the competitors. This was by looking at 243 of the Fortune 500. Even after accounting for contributions to profitability, such as sales, growth, and market position. So the bottom line here is that greener companies tend to promote innovation, conserve valuable resources, and enhance their reputation for both their prospective employers and potential customers.
Now, when a green company is selected by a mutual fund, there are lots of shades of green. So how does one figure out whether it really is green or it is a lot of greenwashing, which I can tell you, running the environment show, I see a lot of.
Well, when you're talking about investing in the largest companies in the country that that exchange on the stock market, you're looking at finding the greener of that group. And so step one is looking for those companies that exceed the current standards, that do better than the minimums required by the law, and have innovative products and services that go beyond the contemporary minimums. So that's what you're looking at when you're looking at the big companies. That's step one, And that's where environmental screens will help you. So a mutual fund, for example, that's screening is already looking at those issues. If you go to your own professional financial advisor or money manager and say, this is what I want, they can use those criteria to help you put your portfolio together. So that's step one. Step two is that as a responsible investor, it's very important to communicate to the companies that this is part of your investment choice, and that as an owner of the company, you expect them to meet or exceed their current good performance.
And so here, some of the pension plans have really played a major role, haven't they? Like New York and California that got companies or tried to get them to sign on to the Valdez principles, which were
environmental principles. And that each of us can do that. When we own stock and we get those proxy voting messages from, you know, those ballots from the company every year, look and see whether or not there are any environmental considerations on the ballot and vote for the environment. Vote to ask management to continuously improve.
I guess that also means if we're a member of a pension plan, we can write our plan managers, because then it's not only our stock, but literally billions of dollars of everybody else's stock, too.
That's exactly right. And that's as how investors, we can continually send the message to the companies that we're watching their environmental performance, we want it to improve, and we'll maybe making our choices based on that.
Linda, do the companies hear that message when they hear it from pension funds and from folks like us?
Absolutely. It's so important for investors to communicate their concerns to companies, because it does help shape corporate strategy and policy. In fact, you know, the increasing interest in these issues on the part of individual investors in the United Kingdom, for example, has led to a proposed law that would require pension funds to state their policy with regard to social investment.
Great. Well, on that, I'm afraid our time is up. That's a pretty good argument for being in a British pension fund. In any event, we've been talking about green investment. My guests have been Elisa Gravitz from the Social Investment Forum, which is a nonprofit group promoting socially responsible investing, and Linda Descano, who is from the Wall Street firm of Solomon Smith Barney. We'd like to hear your views, even some tips on green stocks if you have some, so give us a call. Our number is 1-888-49-GREEN. We've been talking green, and I'm Peter Berlin. You can reach us the old-fashioned way. It's called mail, 318 Central Avenue, Albany, New York, 12206. That's the Environment Show, 318 Central Avenue, Albany, New York, 12206. If that doesn't work, try the net, www.enn.com/envshow.
I'm Linda Anderson, and this is Ear to the Ground, with stories about people affecting change in the environment. This week, Boot Camp for Eco-Warriors. You've seen the pictures of daring activists dangling over the sides of ships or bridges, hanging banners that protest nuclear waste or clear cuts, or perhaps you've wondered about those brave souls floating in rough seas in yellow rubber rafts who place themselves between whales and whalers. Well, very likely, these activists learned their skills from the Ruckus Society, which, according to the organization's director, John Sellers, is a group that trains men and women tactics in nonviolent civil disobedience and in-your-face confrontation.
We train people in very technical skills like urban climbing, climbing buildings and bridges and structures that you would find in cities and harbors to rappel off of and hang banners and blockade ships coming out of a harbor or coming into a harbor. We also teach people tree climbing skills, technical tree climbing skills for use in backcountry, you know, forest defense work in national forests or privately owned forests, setting up tree villages. We teach people blockading of roads and buildings and structures. We also teach people a whole range of theoretical workshops, the use of media in direct action, nonviolence training, banner construction, political theater, direct action planning and strategy, strategic campaign work, a number of online activism and electronics.
The Ruckus Society, headquartered in Berkeley, California, was founded 3 years ago by Mike Rozelle. Rozelle, who'd been involved with groups like Earth First, Rainforest Action Network, and Greenpeace, believed there was a need for more effective strategic use of nonviolent confrontations in organizations working for environmental justice issues as well as human rights. So he tapped the technical skills of experienced activists to teach other activists. To date, Sellers says the Ruckus Society has trained more than 1,000 people in over 12 camps throughout the country. Many participants may come from large organizations like Greenpeace or Friends of the Earth, but they are just as likely to come from small, local grassroots organizations as well.
When we conduct our training camps, we try to follow the lead of local grassroots organizations on the ground in whatever bioregion that we elect to go into. So we receive a number of proposals throughout the year, and then take a look at those proposals and base our schedule, our calendar for the year, on the need and sort of the political impact that we'll have in a given region as we go into that region. And then we work in partnership with those local groups on the ground to actually pull off and coordinate the camp.
The camps, Sellers says, last from 4 to 6 days in length and have anywhere between 40 and 80 students and 20 to 40 facilitators, trainers, and volunteers. Training is free to participants. All they need to do is provide their own transportation. Sellers says that's because funding comes from various foundations and individuals that support the efforts of the Ruckus Society. As for the actual activists, many people may see them as extremists, but Sellers says they are merely people who are serious about affecting change. As you might expect, he says, there are the classic lefty college students who are idealistic and think critically about changing the world. But he adds, there are many others.
You know, we've trained people well into their 60s and 70s that, you know, were living in a community that was put at risk by, you know, some kind of irresponsible corporation or government practice, and were sort of dragged out of everyday life into activism and realized that, you know, the governments and multinational corporations are not behaving responsibly, and that, in fact, we do need to challenge them and be confrontational.
The direct action work being taught by the Ruckus Society is all about getting attention in a big way, drawing the public's eye to areas and issues of concern in ways that can be funny or splashy or dead serious, but always, Seller stresses, nonviolent. He says their work challenges as well as inspires people. Whether it's blocking whalers' harpoons or suspending banners from bridges, the Ruckus Society operates under the principle that actions speak louder than words. With Ear to the Ground, I'm Linda Anderson.
Thanks for being with us on this week's Environment Show. I'm Peter Burley. The year 2000 computer program that was going to dispose of all New York City trash was carried off by a great horned owl who deposited it in a pagoda in Burma. Learn where to find it by ordering a copy of the show. 1-800-323-9262, show number 478. The Environment Show is a national production which is solely responsible for its content. Alan Shartok is executive producer, Stephen Westcott is producer, and Ray Graff is audio engineer. The Environment Show is made possible by the W. Walton Jones Foundation, the William Bingham Foundation, the Turner Foundation, the J.M. Kaplan Fund, and Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the collector car hobby. www.henmings.com. Be good to the Earth and join us next week for the Environment Show.